The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Extra from The Guardian. This is the full interview with Ben Goldacre, doctor and author of Bad Science. Your book finally has been published. There's a copy of it actually here on the desk in front of us. But, you know, better late than never. It's being serialised in The Guardian. Tell us a bit about the themes you're going to cover. It's not just a collection of columns from the last 5 years. You've been doing bad science for that long now. So what was the sort of driver behind this?
I guess, I mean, mainly it's a popular science book about epidemiology and evidence-based medicine. And I can see you all look very excited by that. Which it astonishes me that nobody's ever written one before. If you look at all of the science coverage in national mainstream newspapers, you find that about half of it is about health. And most of that is about the evidence on what will kill or cure you. You know, the Daily Mail's kind of ongoing Sisyphean mythical task of dividing all the inanimate objects in the world, really, into the ones that will either cause or cure cancer. So this is something that people are very interested in. But there's never once been in the Science Museum an exhibit about evidence-based medicine, despite the fact that it's the applied science that's probably saved more lives in the past 50 years than any other. It's not taught in schools. And that struck me as being an extraordinary disparity that leaves the field open for a lot of very misleading claims to be made.
And it's a confusing world. I mean, there's statistics in there. There's all sorts of claim and counterclaim, which is the seam that you've been mining in the column for a few years.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, what's really useful about quackery as a way of teaching evidence-based medicine is that the errors that they make are very simple and straightforward. So the book, I like to fantasise, follows a kind of natural crescendo where we start off looking at how the evidence on homeopathy has been distorted and misrepresented and how you do a trial, because obviously homeopathy is basically the perfect teaching case for doing a randomised control trial. It is a pill that seems to perform better than a sugar pill, and the whole process of critically appraising scientific literature in medicine is all about trying not to get caught out and making that error. And then we sort of go up through the nutrition and the $50 billion food supplement pill industry until we're ready to take on the $600 billion pharmaceutical industry, which gets a pretty round kicking, I'm very pleased to be able
we kind of go on ad nauseum in this podcast and in pieces we write too about homeopathy and in our blogs, we get quite good responses about, you know, to point out, you know, that there's no evidence base and so on and so on. But what is it that you've talked about in this book? I mean, what is it you've added to that? Are you trying to explain to people how a medicine gets approved, effectively, how it's proved to work? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, to me, homeopathy is only really a teaching device. I mean, you've got to think about why homeopathy is interesting. And
the reason I ask that is because you can kind of imagine, well, look, it's an easy target, isn't it, homeopathy?
Yeah. I mean, the whole purpose of talking about homeopathy is because, as I said, it's a good, clean teaching case for learning about evidence-based medicine. And it's the perfect opportunity because you'll find homeopaths quoting trials which have really basic flaws, things like, you know, no blinding or inadequate randomization. You also see them sort of misquoting and misrepresenting meta-analyses and systematic reviews of scientific literature. And it's the perfect way to talk about that. And obviously homeopaths also make themselves funny by behaving very badly when their ideas are questioned, and that makes them funny, which is a sweetener on the cake. But really, you know, it's a way of getting from A to B to me. I mean, in my kind of day job, I do things like, you know, teach medical students and doctors about critically appraising clinical trial methodology or drug company bullshit, as I was delighted to see my lecture was actually called in the UCL timetable recently. And I think it's important to be able to take the really kind of difficult ideas of critically appraising pharmaceutical trial methodology, where they're trying to kind of bluff and pull the wool over the eyes of doctors who are trained and taught to spot methodological flaws in scientific evidence and claims that are being made to them. I think it's really important to be able to translate some of that into everyday lay language. And that's only doable if you start off with an easy example. And you know, homeopathy is that.
Well, the people in the pod here are itching to ask questions, but I'm going to just ask one more quickly before opening it up. You've got homeopathy there, but can you just run us through a couple of the other examples in the book, maybe one or two other ones we can maybe end up talking about?
Yeah, well, I do The Truth About Nutritionists, which I think is a very important one because, I mean, there's no doubt that food has become the kind of bollocks du jour, if I'm allowed to. Is this an adult audience?
Please, swear all you like.
Really? Can I act properly? No, I always think it sounds rather crass. The whole story of sort of how nutrition has become the bollocks du jour, and that's a sort of slightly more sophisticated way that they misrepresent evidence. But there's also a lot about kind of looking at why these dodgy ideas are so seductive. So, I mean, there's a huge chunk on the placebo effect going through all of the most recent evidence looking at that, but also stuff on sort of cognitive biases and the psychological research into irrational beliefs, which I think is also very interesting because that's the reason why you do statistics. That's the reason why you study things systematically, is because you want to avoid being caught out by the kind of biases inherent in intuition.
You want to take the human being out of it, essentially.
No. I mean, what's interesting about looking at irrationality from a kind of research perspective is you realise that intuition is actually very valuable for questions in something like the social domain. You know, should I trust this business partner? You know, is this somebody I want to shack up with and have babies with? But it's very, very bad for deciding whether MMR causes autism, for example. Especially when, as I demonstrate in my painfully lengthy and detailed chapter, people never stood a chance making an intuitive judgment call on MMR and autism because the media deliberately and unanimously distorted the experimental evidence on it in what can only be a very cynical and deliberate way.
We'll come back to science and the media a bit later. James, you've got a question.
This sort of kind of links in with what you were saying about cognitive biases. Why do you think it is the case? I mean, despite your efforts, your kind of tireless efforts to educate the world via the internet and The Guardian about what constitutes bad science, why is it the case that, you know, go onto Google and you will find millions of kind of magnetic cures and places selling homeopathy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, there seems to be a massive appetite for this sort of thing.
Well, in the book, I very deliberately don't go into, you know, what's the appeal of quackery and why are these things seductive. I don't do the social critique on the appeal of quackery because I don't think that's... I wanted to write about the evidence. But it is very interesting. I mean, there are a lot of things that drive it. I think people want there to be sort of convenient, straightforward solutions in pills for what could more sensibly be thought of as sort of social, political and personal problems. And that's very obvious in the case of the Durham fish oil sort of bogus trial, effectively, the trial that wasn't really a trial. That was a great example of people wanting there to be a pill that would solve a complex social problem, a pill that would improve school performance and behaviour, because we kind of don't want to talk about the social and political issues that drive poor performance in schools. There's a paradox in the appeal of alternative therapies, which is that alternative therapists accuse doctors of being paternalistic and didactic, and they claim that they are holistic. Whereas actually, to me, it seems to be the other way around. I mean, if you look at the Newsnight sting, where they sent a sort of bogus student to 10 homeopaths and said, oh, I'm going to a malaria area. What should I do? Should I take homeopathic malaria tablets? And 9 out of 10 of the homeopaths said, yes, do that. But strikingly, they didn't give the kind of basic bite prevention advice that I would give to my mates. You know, if my mate said, I don't want to take Larium because it makes me have nightmares and sweat and it's a horrible drug, I'd say, well, fair enough. But, you know, cover up, don't sleep next to a marsh, use a mosquito net, don't leave the windows open and don't walk around with bare legs at dusk. And none of the homeopaths said that. And that, to me, is what is holistic. You know, all of the bite prevention advice, not which pill you choose to give people. And actually, when I look at quacks, when I see people giving this very kind of paternalistic, didactic health advice that relies on their authoritative appeal to arcane, hidden knowledge to which they have privileged access. And it all feels like very old-fashioned Victorian medicine. And I think the appeal of homeopaths and perhaps even people at the other end of the scale like Gillian McKeith is that they offer a very, very old-fashioned Victorian, stern, paternalistic brand of medicine, which doctors today just don't do. Doctors today will say, well, you know, here's the evidence. You know, we could do this, we could do that. It might have the following side effects. I don't know. What do you think? And I think the right...
Doctors never said that to me.
Really?
No.
Well, what kind of problems have you gone to doctors with, then?
Okay, well, we're not going to discuss James's medical problems.
I don't want to get into that.
Actually, I know the answer to that question.
No, quite seriously. I mean, a doctor's never discussed, what do you think? Here's the options. Mm. They usually say, in my professional judgment, this is... They might discuss side effects, okay.
I'm slightly disappointed to hear that.
Doctors have about 7 minutes, don't they, per patient?
This is the problem, yeah.
Well, actually, and that's the other thing, obviously.
This is an interesting point that Marcus raises. The doctors have about 7 minutes, they're rushed. This also came up. Simon Singh and Ed Zardernst written a book recently, Trick or Treatment, which, according to Simon is essentially also, in the same way that you're doing, Ben, a history of evidence-based medicine. He was talking about how it is that you end up working out what works and what doesn't work. And he uses the homeopathy example as well. But at a lecture he gave at the Hay Festival, I remember something quite interesting coming out of it, which was that perhaps doctors, medical doctors, could learn a thing or two from the way that homeopaths treat their patients, i.e. this idea of sitting down with them and giving them more time. Of course, you know, practicalities may go one way or the other. And perhaps there's something they can learn. I mean, would you at least go that far to say that homeopaths have got that bit right?
Well, I mean, I disagree with a lot of what Simon Singh and Ed Zardernst have been saying recently, actually, because they're quite stern on homeopathy. They want it, you know, banned from the NHS and write letters to the Times and that kind of thing, which I disagree with. I'm actually very happy for people to spend their money on quackery, and I can see a role for the placebo effect if it can be used in a sort of ethical way. I think there's nothing to be learned from homeopaths, because homeopaths essentially mislead their patients with regard to the evidence. But there is, as I said in my two-part series on the placebo on Radio 4, that there's a huge amount to be learnt from the scientific research into the placebo effect, because there's a lot that we know now about the ways that the placebo effect can be enhanced. And to me, the real secret is learning how to use that research to enhance the benefits from treatments which do actually have an effect in and of themselves without having to mislead or lie to patients. Because I guess other professions, if they want to, can lie to their patients, but I think doctors have a special responsibility. I think you could say that in one individual case it would be acceptable to mislead a patient because that would have the kind of instrumental outcome of perhaps they might get better. But overall, you kind of devalue the coin of medical utterances, because people come to realise that doctors may well, you know, lie to you in the process of getting you better. I mean, communication skills teaching at medical school 30 years ago was how to tell people, how not to tell people that they had cancer. Whereas now it's you know, how to engage collaboratively with them.
This is actually exactly Simon's point. Simon and Edzard, they made a point of saying that pharmacists, trained pharmacists who've got degrees in pharmacology, they shouldn't sell homeopathic medicines because they know that they're doing nothing. They shouldn't be lying to their patients in saying this is going to help you.
I think individual practitioners must be entirely free to do absolutely whatever they want.
Argue that but
what happens? But what happens is they devalue the coin of their profession, and so it's absolutely true. I mean, I have very little respect for Boots now that I know that they sell pills which have no medicine in them and work only as placebos, as if they were effective. That, to me, means that I don't trust what Boots say anymore. And I think we all make our own judgments about how reliable people are. And ultimately, pharmacists devalue themselves by selling things like homeopathy or vitamin pills with claims that clearly aren't true. And you know, that's entirely their own right. And, you know, they can do that and they must suffer the consequences.
All right, Ben. Well, we're going to come back to you a bit later in the programme.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Developments on the homeopathy front after the University of Central Lancashire suspended its course on it. The degree in homeopathic medicine has stopped recruiting new students after relentless attacks from the Anti-Homeopathy League. One of those being blamed for all the bad press is Professor David Colquhoun, a pharmacologist at University College London. We asked him why homeopathy was such a bad thing.
Because it's not science. I've got no objection to it being taught as anthropology or cultural history or history of medicine. Very interesting topic. I mean, it's a fascinating topic, actually, why so many believe things which turn out, when properly investigated, not to be true. But you can't, it's not science. The science is to do with distinguishing between things that are true and things that are false. And in most cases where these things are investigated thoroughly, they turn out to be false. Universities will say, but they have proper physiology and pharmacology as well. But if you put to them a critical point, you get no answer. And the critical point is that, apropos of homeopathy, for example, the lectures on physiology and biochemistry will tell them that the bigger the dose you give, the larger the effect will be, by and large. Whereas the lectures on homeopathy on the other days will tell them exactly the opposite. Well, which are they to believe? it's rather ludicrous to combine lectures on scientific and non-scientific topics when they're going to contradict each other, And of course, they're required in the end to believe the homeopathic one, because these are not pure science degrees, they're vocational degrees. They boast about how you can get immediate employment as a homeopath. So they've got to believe the junk ones.
Professor David Colquhoun from the University College London there. Ben, you're a big fan of David's. He's a lovely man.
Funniest man I know.
He's also, his blog, dcscience.net, is a great sort of source of anti-homeopathy stuff. I mean, essentially, we don't want to make you talk about homeopathy the whole time you're here.
Please.
But I mean, you must be pleased that this university is not doing a BSc in homeopathic medicine now.
I think that is infinitely, infinitely more important than the question of whether homeopathy should be on the NHS. I think, I mean, this might be the sort of pragmatism of somebody who's sort of practiced medicine more recently than some of the people who campaign viciously against homeopathy. But I don't object so much to homeopathy on the NHS. But people being taught that cherry-picking, that quoting inept, methodologically inadequate trials and all of the rest is an appropriate way to get a BSc, a science degree. I mean, it annoys me so much I can barely construct a sentence.
All right, well, we'll construct a sentence in response to this next question in that case, a completely separate subject. I mean, your book, as you said, it's all about this sort of quackery stuff, but also in your sort of articles and your speeches and lectures and things,
I mean, very little of it is about quackery, actually. The majority.
I was going to say that in the last few years, another thesis has sort of been emerging in the kind of the lectures and things you've been giving, which is the relationship between how science is covered in the media, basically, science and the media. And, you know, you write in the media, so, you know, this is a sort of a slightly inward-looking thing, but you hinted this earlier, and you've said this before, but you believe that science shouldn't be covered in news. Now, why is that?
I think that science naturally is a much better subject for the feature section of a newspaper, because firstly, the kinds of things that make a science story newsworthy are also the things that make it a little bit more likely to be wrong. You know, it's a new piece of information that's transgressive. It's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily fit with previous findings. That's what makes it newsworthy, but that's also what makes it more likely to be subsequently turn out to be untrue. So I think, firstly, it misrepresents science by suggesting that science is all about very fragile new breakthroughs. But also, more importantly, the way that science moves forward is by the gradual emergence of new themes supported by a raft of evidence in a number of different disciplines. And so that's a feature subject. That's not a new subject about a single experiment that has a new result.
So does that mean that, the argument you just put forward is kind of probably makes sense for things like medical stories, you know, if I'm playing devil's advocate.
I think for basic science more,
but
actually.
What about all the other sort of stories that are covered more generally, things like about dinosaurs or space or all that kind of stuff? If people just want to know about, say, the Large Hadron Collider, we're going to tell them about the way the particle physics experiments there are going to work. Would you chuck out all of that?
No,
from the news sections.
No, of course not.
But are you talking about a subset of news?
I think it's a major tragedy that there's no science features in The Guardian anymore. I mean, I think that's a real... Given that we've got... I mean, without wanting to sort of massage you all under the table, we do have a very, very, very... Sorry, that was quite rude. A very strong group of science writers at The Guardian.
There's no massaging going on here, trust me.
Everybody's looking a bit stern and worried now. Obviously, you need a balance. But actually, I think, you know, developments in molecular biology or you know, developments in all kinds of theoretical fields are much better covered as features. And actually, a sudden breakthrough in a treatment, you know, a large clinical trial which has a very significant result, or better still, a systematic review or a meta-analysis that has a large significant result, probably is one of the few things I would count as being newsworthy rather than feature-worthy. But I'm biased. I mean, I find it difficult to understand the point of news in general. I mean, the sort of daily ebb and flow of sort of little updates about what's happening in the Middle East, to me, isn't as interesting as what's, you know, at the end of the year. You know,
we'll get you into a fight with our news editor later. James?
Well, as you might expect, I have to say I completely disagree that you shouldn't put science in the news pages of a newspaper. I mean, it seems to me an absurd suggestion, because I agree with you to the extent that, you know, we should have more science features, and writing about science in a longer form is good because it gives you certain advantages that you don't have in a news context. But what you're advocating is taking out a massive source of information about science from people who would never see it otherwise. So the entire population would be denuded of information about science and what's going on in science, apart from the fact that a lot of them might be very interested in it. they've paid for it by and large, mostly, and they have a right to know about it. You're right that there is a certain proportion of stories that are badly reported, but I think to attack news coverage in general because of that is a straw man.
I'm not suggesting that there should be no science news reporting, but I think that the sacrifices that are made, more so in other newspapers than in this one, to crowbar a science story into the news format are very, very significant. In a feature, you have the opportunity to expand on things and also talk about background. I mean, one of the biggest problems in communicating science clearly to a motivated lay audience, because that's the problem. It's not the problem isn't that people are clever or stupid, it's just that they're lacking background knowledge and they're lacking interest. The problem with communicating science to a motivated lay audience is usually that they don't have the background knowledge. And I think in news, you've got less of a chance of filling them in on the background than you do in features. But it's not an absolute. I'm not saying there should be no science news. That would be clearly preposterous.
No?
I was going to say, I mean, earlier when you were talking about the MMR, you said that the media reporting of it had been cynical and deliberately misleading.
Spectacularly poor. Yeah.
Which doesn't really represent any of the science reporters I know. They're not cynical particularly, or don't set out to deliberately mislead the public.
No, but that's what's very, very interesting. If you look at the reporting of the MMR hoax, as I believe it will come to be known, and it's the media's hoax, nothing to do with Andrew Wakefield, who I think is a very interesting figure, but not somebody I would hold in any low regard, actually. I would defend Andrew Wakefield against the onslaught that he's probably going to be subjected to by journalists trying to pin the blame for the MMR scare onto him over the next few months. But what was very interesting about the reporting of the MMR hoax was it wasn't done by specialist science and health reporters. Whenever a science story becomes a major political issue, it's taken out of the hands of specialist health and science reporters and put into the hands of generalists. So in 2002, for example, which was the peak of the MMR coverage, there were over 1,200 articles that year and no more than 100 in 1998 when the scare began. 80% of all articles about MMR were written by generalists. They were written by, you know, the Suzanne Moore and Linda Lee Potter and you know, the kind of people who'd normally be writing funny columns about a very sort of silly thing that the au pair said on the way to a dinner party, were suddenly giving the public the benefit of their wisdom on complex issues of immunology and epidemiology. And that was the problem with the science reporting, is that it wasn't done by specialist science and health reporters. You saw exactly the same thing in the GM food, Frankenstein food sort of front page thing in 98, when for the first 2 days after that story broke, not a single one of the news or comment pieces in any national newspaper was written by a specialist health or science correspondent. They were all written by generalists, and it's the generalists who cover things very badly.
I want to bring you back and draw you back to your sort of harder position, which you made before, because you're sort of rowing away from it at the moment. You're being very kind to us and saying the people who make mistakes are the non-specialists, and you're also saying that some of the stories are, well, you know, there's a proportion of stories that are bad, and I want to get rid of them, but the rest of the stuff is okay because there's good science stuff that can go into news. But you know, really, you're saying that science. I mean, coming back to your point about adding context to a story, you're saying science shouldn't be told in news because you haven't got the space to give someone the background knowledge to understand it. Now, you could say that about any area of human endeavour, I think. You know, I mean, I know next to nothing about economics, but I'm interested in reading economic stories that may or may not influence my life, probably will. And I don't get all the background about economics theory, but I get enough to kind of understand what's going on. And if I want to know more, maybe I'll go and search on the internet and find out more. What's wrong with giving someone a taste of what's going on in a story without misleading them? I would never defend doing that, of course. But what's wrong with giving them a taste? And, you know, even if you're not able to put 1,000 words of background into, you know, the last 10 years of research.
You see, I have a sense that science gets dumbed down much more significantly than things like economics, sport, or literature. I feel jealous.
Because you're a scientist.
When I read the book pages, I see that people are allowed to write, you know, 4-page-long essays in which the more obscure Russian novelists you can quote, the better a writer everybody thinks you are. When I read the economics pages or the sports pages,
You're not comparing light with light.
When I read economics and sports news, I don't understand what they're talking
about. Literary pages where people are making obscure references to Russian authors, those are features. They're not news stories. When you read about, you know, say, the two Titian paintings that are trying to be saved at the moment, everything in those stories would be understandable by a 12-year-old.
My experience of reading things like literature pages and economics news and sports news is that there are undefined terms which are entirely unfamiliar to me, and as unfamiliar to me as the kinds of things that I would think it would be acceptable to put into a science article, but which you would be forced to take out or forced to define.
Marcus, you're a scientist turned writer. Tell us what you, out of this conversation, whose side are you sort of on here? Do you think that news is a terrible medium to communicate scientific ideas? I mean, you mainly write features and books.
I think it is a difficult medium, but we don't live in an ideal world, unfortunately, you know, where there is a lot of space and there's a lot of competition. What appears in science news in newspapers is a lot better than, for instance, what appears on television, where the competition is even greater. You know, and there, if you're at a news meeting, unless you mention, you know, you want to do a physics story or whatever, unless you mention Stephen Hawking, you can forget it. You know, unless you mention some incredible breakthrough with some figure like him, you can forget it. So, I think to some extent, I do think you're absolutely right about the fact that everything is portrayed as a breakthrough. And certainly in particle physics or cosmology or whatever, there are very, very few breakthroughs. It's exactly the same as in medicine. All science is exactly the same.
I was going to actually pick up on your sports references, which is, I'm not sure that you necessarily want to go down that route of thinking that you don't have to explain, of wanting to be able to be like a sports news story in that you've got certain terms that you're not going to bother to explain, whether it's a kind of particular golf shot or whatever it is. I mean, surely we're better than that, and you shouldn't be kind of envious of sport for not being in that league.
So I think that's really interesting because, to my mind, until the internet came along, it was the geeks who were most neglected in popular culture. It was the people who were already kind of interested in science because they'd done a biochemistry degree at Leicester and now worked in senior management at Woolworths. They were the people where there was actually very little in mainstream popular culture for them. I mean, television's obviously dumbed down ridiculously, but also in general print media, unless people went out of their way to seek it out, there was nothing to keep their kind of nerd muscles in tone. And I think it's a shame to dumb everything down to the point where there's not anything to give sort of any kind of substantial nourishment to people with those kinds of interests. I mean, actually now I think the most exciting thing that's happened to public engagement with science is undoubtedly blogging. And I'm speaking at the Nature Science Bloggers Conference, which is going to be brilliant. And actually, the other thing I really noticed is I ran into the guy who does Mind Hacks, which is one of the most fantastic blogs ever, popular sort of psychology stuff, and also the guy who does neurophilosophy. And I ran into him at the conference, and I realised that they were kind of more famous to me than the sort of TV presenter sciencey people there, because I'd really engaged with their stuff, and also they were telling me things that were really interesting that I didn't know, in a way that Robert Winston, in his endlessly repetitive dumbed-down programmes, has never, ever done. And I think, actually, that kind of unmediated communication, postdocs communicating in everyday language but to a highly motivated audience who have chosen to seek them out, is actually, you know, it kind of makes any discussion about whether the media can adequately inform and entertain nerds completely irrelevant. You know, when you've got things like Mind Hacks and neurophilosophy and everything on science blogs...
We're meant for, is it, though?
Well, it's nerds care about the most, actually. And I feel that they have been massively neglected, particularly by the kind of self-styled public engagement with science community, you know, the people that we always run into at those parties at the Welcome or whatever. And they're always running, you know, they're telling you about, oh, we've done this great new BMX move and it's called the Einstein stunt and we got the kids in to, you know, divine this manoeuvre and that's really cool because it's going to get everyone interested in Einstein and here's a ballet with everybody with names of elements from the periodic table painted on their tutus. I mean, it just makes me want to slam my cock in the door. And I think that...
But hold on, that's not really what public engagement with science is about. And what we're not talking about is, I mean, nerds can find their blogs and nerds can find that community, and it's great that community's been growing in the past 5 years or whatever. But what we started off talking about was average news stories in the papers day to day. And that's stuff that all of my English lit friends want to know about and are interested in and aren't going to go onto a nerd site in order to find out about. But we ought to be feeding them that information in some comprehensible way.
That's fine, and Horses for Courses is all very cool, but the nerds were massively neglected by popular culture. And actually, I think newspaper and television let them down really badly. And actually, the only place where really you get good science now, I think, is on Radio 4. And there's an interesting reason for that, and that is, if you listen to a Radio 4 science documentary, 80% of the spoken word content is made up by scientists themselves speaking about either their own work or the field that they work in that they're very familiar in. And that's how you make good, that's how you communicate science properly, by facilitating the people who already know about it to write about it and to talk about it. I actually think that the world needs less science writers and more good editors. We need people who can help people who work in various different difficult fields. We need people who can help them and shepherd them into expressing the kind of work that they do in their own words.
Marcus, do you agree?
No, I don't agree.
Brilliant.
I listen to those programs on Radio 4, and as somebody who, you know, I listen to a program about cosmology or physics or something, and I will know that a lot of jargon is uttered by those physicists that I understand, but I would guess that the average listener doesn't understand at all.
Okay, what Radio 4 Science show are you talking about?
Well, you know, I mean, things like, I'm trying to remember the programmes, the Melvin Bragg programmes, he tends not to get them to define the things that they're talking about. I think you do need science writers. I'm a science writer, and I talk to people, I'm an interpreter, I talk to people in their language, physicists in their language, and then I try and communicate that to people who don't have any background at all. I mean, my model is my wife, who has no science background. She's a nurse, but she has a medical background, but no physics background. That's the kind of people I talk to. And I think you kind of belittle the skill required in communicating science, and that there are many scientists who have a very profound understanding of the world but can't communicate it. There are science writers who can write very well but don't have any profound understanding, but there are still these people who can create the bridge. And they are worthy.
I absolutely agree that they're very valuable, but I just don't see why. I mean, why should we want to interpose ourselves between the scientist and the public? What's wrong with just helping somebody to express themselves?
Because they're so bad at it. You know, I'm constantly amazed. I'm constantly amazed at the people that I interview, for instance, and I can't understand how they've got such a deep understanding. And yet they couldn't communicate it to anybody, you know. And I have to use all of my knowledge to try and interpret this. I'm very, very surprised, because the people at the very top of the tree, I was taught when I was at Caltech in America by Richard Feynman, who was probably one of the greatest physicists who ever lived. But he was also a great communicator, and he could explain quantum theory to someone waiting for a number 52 bus. But he was very, very unusual. And most physicists, what he could do is he could remember what it was like before he understood. And most scientists I know cannot remember what it was like before they understood. They can't remember what it was like when they were 10.
And I think that's what you're trying to do when you're writing about science on a newspaper or whatever, is to add that courtesy, that little explanation. It's not dumbing down, it's adding a little explanation, a little expansion on what, you know, even if it's a subclause that you insert as a sub-editor to explain what a term means. That's what you're aiming for.
We'll have to leave that stuff there, I think. This is obviously something that will continue on and on and on. Ben, thanks very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.